This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When American TV networks pulled their reporters out of Baghdad 1 year ago before the bombing began, freelance journalist Richard Engel stayed. He was the only American TV correspondent to remain in Baghdad through the shock and awe campaign. He often reported live while the bombs were falling. There were times he reported through the day and the night, living on what he describes as adrenaline and buzz. Engel is still reporting in Iraq, now as a correspondent for NBC News. He's briefly in the U.S. for the publication of his new memoir, A Fist in the Hornet's Nest, on the ground in Baghdad before, during, and after the war. Engel has been covering the Middle East since 1996 and taught himself to speak Arabic. He's reported for the BBC, Voice of America, and the public radio program The World. He's also edited English-language publications in Cairo and Jerusalem. But when he went to Iraq before the war, he wasn't able to use his credentials as a journalist to enter the country.
During the build-up to the war, the Iraqi regime became very strict about the number of visas that it was issuing for journalists. And I was a journalist at the time, but I couldn't obtain a reporting visa. The major networks were only given one or sometimes two visas each. And so agencies like CNN or BBC were saving those prized visas for their star correspondents. And I was a freelance journalist at the time, working for public radio and working for ABC. So I wasn't on the top of the list, not anywhere near the list, to receive one of those coveted visas. So I was determined to get in and into Iraq and cover this conflict. So I actually got a human shield visa. These were issued by the Iraqi government for people who wanted to go to Iraq and express solidarity with the government and tie themselves to oil refineries and things like that. And so I was able to get in using this guise, and then I was hoping once I got there to try and convert it into a reporting visa. And it was after a long time and having to leave the country and going from one place to another and then eventually come back, I did in the end manage to secure the proper credentials.
Was there ever a point where you expected to play the part of the human shield?
No, I had no intention of being a human shield. I hoped that would just get me in the door. And then once I was on the inside, I would be able to secure a reporting visa. I didn't ever want to be a human shield. I didn't want to make a documentary or any kind of... I wanted to do normal news coverage. And I knew that I wouldn't be able to do that unless I had the proper credentials, because the way the system was set up at the time, every time you left the hotel where you were staying, which you had to register with local authorities, you were required to go with a minder. So as a foreigner, I wouldn't have been able to walk around very easily and have done reporting without... I did some of that, but it was very difficult under the old system to have done any kind of reporting without the proper credentials. And then I certainly would have looked like a spy, and then I would have been arrested or killed. And it was a road I didn't want to go down.
What was it like for you when most of the American journalists were leaving Iraq and you were staying?
I was very worried. I thought, do they know something that I don't know? Am I making the right decision? Am I being a cowboy, as it's sometimes referred to? Not everyone did leave, but most, there was a mass exodus. I think there were about 600 journalists who were there in Baghdad in the immediate buildup to the war. A lot of them were from radio and print and the whole television crews and producers and correspondents and things like that. And then in the very end, I think there was only about maybe less than 100. And the biggest exodus was from the major networks, the television, people who made a decision that it just wasn't worth the risk. And there was significant danger. And so when I was there watching people leave, I was wondering if they were making the right decision. But I felt somewhat more comfortable than some the other people that were there at the time. I've spent a lot of time in the Middle East. It's now about 8 years that I've been in the region, and I speak Arabic, and I knew Iraq. I'd been there on previous visits. I was a one-man band, so I felt that I could, if the situation got very much out of hand, I could go underground and There were many people I found who exhibited really exceptional, many Iraqis who exhibited exceptional bravery and would have, I think, sheltered me and helped me out if the situation, if the authorities decided to round up all of the Westerners in the country, or if there was riots that broke out, or if the bombing became so intense that there was no safe place to be. So I felt somewhat comfortable and didn't think I was really risking my life too much.
How did it make you feel knowing that, you know, ABC and the other TV networks had sent their reporters home, but, you know, they were happy to use you if you were willing to risk your life after they sent their reporters home?
Well, I didn't feel exploited in any way. This was something I wanted to do, and mm-hmm. they were actually very fair with me about that. They told me clearly, we are not telling you or requiring you to be there in any way, and they said that they would have certainly helped me to leave at any stage, and I was in contact with them throughout, and I felt comfortable. It was my decision, and I never was pressured in any way to make it one way or another. But I did feel more comfortable by having more knowledge of the area and being able to move around more or less discreetly. I only had my own little DV, it's a digital video camera, and local people who were helping me to get around, local drivers and fixers. And I built up my own network of people. And this is another thing that I spent a lot of time doing, was working on establishing the right safe houses, the right drivers. At one stage, I had cars parked all over the city, and I told some of them, just keep them running because I never know where I might end up. And I spent a lot of time trying to get people to fix up their own cars so that if I needed to make a getaway, that I would make sure they had gas in it, that they had extra tires, that I had hotel rooms all across the city that had generators and food and crowbars in them. So I really established myself a little safety net. So I felt that I was relying on myself more than anyone else. So I felt somewhat comfortable about it.
Can I point out that this kind of safety net is kind of like a cottage industry, because you basically have to pay everybody as part of this safety net. You know, pay them for their services. In some cases, it's more of a bribe. You had, what, $20,000 taped to your ankle?
I had $20,000 with me at almost all times. And I spent a lot of it. I think I spent about $10,000 just keeping this system going. You know, I didn't think this was the right time to be a cheapskate. So I was spending, you know, if car repairs for one of these guys would end up costing $75 and he was charging me $125, I wasn't going to really negotiate too much, because these were people who I was putting my life in their hands. So, yes, I was paying people for their services to help me out, to drive me to places, to hire people, to be there if I needed them. So I had a lot of redundancy. For example, I was staying in the Palestine. Every day, there was a guy who came and cleaned the floor, cleaned the room, all of the rooms on the floor where I was staying, I should say. Every day I saw him, I gave him $20. He didn't do anything. He didn't come. He didn't clean the room. I gave him $20 just because if something was going on in the hotel, the authorities were coming, I assumed he would be the first to know, and I wanted my room to be the first one he knocked on. So it does cost a little bit of money.
Well, two questions for you. Where did the $20,000 come from? Was it an advance from a network, or was it just like your savings that you brought with you? And the second part of that question is, how do you wrap that much money around your ankle? That's a lot of money. And you can't exactly have $1,000 bills with you.
No, but some of it was an advance from the radio station, The World, which is a public radio station that I was working for. And some of it was my own money. And I kept it in $100 bills in one of these travel sleeves that they sell, and it looks like an ace bandage with a pouch on each side of it. And it was pretty bulky, but at the bottom of your pants, I was usually wearing jeans or khaki pants, there's a little bit of extra room, and you don't notice it so much.
When word gets around that you have that much money, aren't you targeted by people who would be happy to steal it from you?
Well, I made sure that word never got around. I kept most of it in there, but I never told anyone, not even the people who I was who were around me, that I had this money. I would keep an extra grand, or I would keep, you know, at least $500 in my wallet. So if I ever needed to pay somebody, I would just pay it out of my wallet. And then if I ever needed to dip into my safety net, I would keep that around my, I would do that in private. And I also had a money belt in it, you know, with a zipper in the back. So, and I had money stashed away in some of the safe houses as well, hidden in places, because I thought anyway, if I was ever in a bind, the easiest way to get out of it quickly was to have a couple $100 to give myself an extra 5 minutes or to get those extra 3 feet to the door.
You mentioned you had a crowbar in your hotel room. What for?
Well, I had crowbars in hotel rooms all across the all across Baghdad, just in case you needed to. I thought if the door is locked on me from the outside, I could break the lock. Or if the room is damaged in such a way and the door jam shifts and the door becomes stuck, if I'm trapped under something, it's just a useful tool, a useful thing to have a big, sturdy piece of metal when you don't know what the situation is going to, what kind of situation you're going to be in.
My guest is Richard Engel. His new memoir is called A Fist in the Hornet's Nest, on the ground in Baghdad before, during, and after the war. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Richard Engel. He reports from Iraq for NBC News. During the bombing of Baghdad, he reported live for ABC. He was the only American TV correspondent who remained in Baghdad through the bombing campaign. Could you describe what the worst night of the bombing was like for you and where you were while it was happening?
I was on the 14th floor of the Palestine Hotel. I was on my balcony facing west, looking out over the Tigris River. And I was looking at the grounds of the Republican Palace, which was the main Saddam Hussein's main headquarters in Iraq, in Baghdad anyway. And the bombs began most of the time. They were for the first two nights. They had begun around 2 a.m. Or 3 a.m. They began at a similar time on that third night, but the intensity picked up like it hadn't done previously. And then the sky was just yellow with all of the fireballs that were exploding, mainly clustered around this palace compound, which was right across the river from me. And it was like thunder, you know, claps of thunder one after another, and the windows were shaking and the building was swaying. It was like an earthquake almost. And some of the blasts were so close that they would push me back and send my hair blowing backwards like I had my face in front of a hot hair dryer. So it was really a terrifying night. And then waking up in the morning and looking out over the balcony and seeing the city still seemed intact, but I didn't know what to do. You go outside and you don't know if the city's even still standing. We were very cut off from information. So I didn't know if I was going to go outside and find that Baghdad looked like the surface of the moon and that people were going to be, you know, angry and rioting. And as an American wandering around this city, what do I tell people when I see them on the street? So getting out and wandering around very nervously or sheepishly the next morning was also a unique experience.
Were you conscious of trying to not look afraid?
No, I didn't. I was, most of the time when I was on air, I was just running on adrenaline. So I was just trying to get the words out and to try and be there on time. We were in continuous coverage, so it was hard enough to just make sure you had all of the live shots. But then I also had to do reporting. I was the only person. I didn't have a producer who could go out and get elements for me or anybody like that. So I would finish with one program, tear off the mic and jump in a car and then try and gather elements. I was also filming things myself, so I had to gather elements, gather video, try and feed it out in time and then run back to be for the next broadcast. So I had to go out of the building as well so that I could have something to talk about. So most of the time I was so busy that I didn't really have time to think about too much. Well, okay, here, I'm going to stand there. I'm going to look brave or anything like that. By the time I got to the live position, it was usually seconds before I was on air. So I was relieved, if anything, that I made it on time.
How did the the eating problems, the sleeping problems, the all the horrible stuff from the fires and the bombing in the air, the stress, how did all of that, your lack of sleep, how did all of that affect your overall health and your ability to function, you know, well enough to perform?
Well, I was actually quite sick for the last, for the middle 10 days of the war. I was in an interview with, for example, with Tariq Aziz, and I had to call off the interview in the middle. I was coughing so badly. I started sweating. He was trying to give his answers, and I was just coughing and coughing. I couldn't stop myself. So at one stage, he offered me a glass of water, and I said, thank you very much. And then as he was leaving the room, I joked. I said, listen, I'm sorry if I got you sick. I'm an American biological weapon here. So I got sick because of the lack of sleep and running around.
And did you still report while you were that sick?
Yeah, of course. You know, the adrenaline is an amazing chemical. I think more research needs to be done. When you're totally flooded with adrenaline, you're on national TV and the war is going on, you can handle a lot of virus.
While you were in Baghdad, I think this was during the war, maybe it was right before the war, you came across DVDs that were being sold of tortures and executions, real ones, not staged ones. What was the source of those DVDs?
Yeah, all of this material came out after the war. This is all the stuff that had been taking place during the regime, and then suddenly, when this the lid was taken off this boiling pot, all of the evil that had been going on behind closed doors came to the surface. So tapes started emerging that were from that had been taken by one of the many or many of the Iraqi security services. Some of them showed executions, particularly of Shiite Muslims during the Iran-Iraq war. There were other videos of amputations, so people who had been who'd upset one of the more senior officials like Uday or Hussein. And Saddam Hussein, and they had videotaped the amputation of the hand, for example. Other times, I saw a tape of someone who had plastic explosive stuffed in his pocket and then was blown to bits. So there was lots of this. This was a regime, although it was disorganized on many levels, it was extremely keen on keeping files and keeping records of things, particularly video records. So there was lots of information that emerged after the regime. And then it was being sold openly on the streets because Iraqis themselves had heard about all these atrocities that were going on. And some Iraqis had experienced them themselves, and they wanted to, I think it was somewhat of a cathartic process for them to view these tapes and to buy these tapes and to sit around collectively and watch them and shake their heads at the in disgust at what had happened. So there's quite a bit of this material that has now emerged since the collapse.
Mm-hmm. And you got to see them?
Yeah, I saw them. I have a little bit of a sort of a morbid collection of all of these things that I, because you accumulate lots of stuff, and I think it's a good window into what the regime was like, and you can understand why these people, why the Iraqis are having such a tough time coming to terms with their past and with their future. There's a lot of healing that still needs to take place, and it's difficult to do that healing when they feel that they're still in this chaotic environment that they're in right now.
From what you've seen in Iraq, do you think that the end of the Saddam Hussein regime is decreasing the power of terrorist networks, or do you think it's attracting more terrorists and inspiring more would-be terrorists to become terrorists?
I think it's attracting. It's become a magnet for terrorists around the world, and has become a training ground, a proving ground for local terrorists to rise up. There has been some arguments that it's better to fight them in Iraq because, you know, you'll draw in all of the terrorists to Iraq and you can kill them there, so you don't have to fight them in New York or New Jersey or wherever. And that's what some of the local commanders in the U.S., local U.S. commanders are telling the troops in Iraq. It is one theory, and maybe it will prove to be correct, but that assumes that there are a definable number of terrorists, that there's a finite number of people who want to fight against the against Americans or American interests. One could just as easily argue that this situation in there and the chaos that's on the ground is attracting more and recruiting people who were never even considering this kind of behavior. So I think it's there are certainly more people from Al Qaeda and that kind of network in Iraq now than there ever were.
Why have you stayed in Iraq?
Well, I got a job that wants me to be there, for one, and I think it's fascinating. I wouldn't feel satisfied at all if I had seen the old system as before and then watch it get pulled down and then to leave it mid-story, as it would be. The story is not over yet, and there would be no satisfaction for me to leave and be like getting up in the middle of the movie. And it's a great movie.
Well, Richard Engel, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, it's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Richard Engel's new memoir is called A Fist in the Hornet's Nest, On the Ground in Baghdad Before, During, and After the War. He now reports for NBC News. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.